In fact, during every school holiday, letters to King George, which of course we never posted, became very popular again. The tadpole angel was back in town, and Geert used to swear the trouble in the prison was almost non-existent during these periods. Geert, with encouragement from Mrs. Boxall, had tackled English and now spoke it fairly well. He'd become very attached to Doc and Mrs. Boxall, and made sure that the repairs around Doc's cottage or Mrs. Boxall's house were done, and that Charlie's motor was kept going. Every time I'd get home, it would be the same thing. "I'm telling you, man, only chewing gum and axle grease is holding that old chorry together. One day I'm just going to have to take it to a clifftop, say a prayer, and push it over. Only it won't be able to make it up the hill in the first place." But under Geert's concerned and tender care, Charlie kept going. Klipkop had been transferred to Pretoria, and Geert, to his enormous surprise, had been given the job of assistant to Captain Smit. As a consequence, he had earned his corporal's stripes. He was now the prison heavyweight, and would be fighting for the vacant title at the next championships. The giant Potgieter, who had continued to beat Geert in the final of the two subsequent championships after Geert's original defeat in Nelspruit, had turned professional. The Lowveld Championships had been expanded, and were now known as the Eastern Transvaal Championships, bringing in some of the bigger towns and making it tougher for the Barberton Blues. As they always occurred during the December school holidays, it was important to Captain Smit that I take part as a member of the Blues. Regular boxing against the Afrikaans schools during term had made me a much better boxer, although I personally longed for the magic of Giel Piet, who knew how to make me think better in the ring. Whereas Darby White and Sarge, like Captain Smit, were honest carpenters, Giel Piet had been an artist, and I missed his uncanny understanding of how to exploit my personality in the ring. I felt I wasn't growing as a boxer. Yehudi Menuhin once said that playing the violin is like singing through your limbs. Giel Piet had had the ability to make boxing seem the same. Each punch the result of perfect timing, continuity, controlled emotion, and intelligence. If I was to become the welterweight champion of the world, I knew I'd soon have to find a coach who thought beyond schoolboy boxing. The holidays were packed. I'd be at the prison at 5:30 a.m. for boxing, and Captain Smit would make me go three rounds with two of the other kids, mostly with Snotnose and Yarpie, both heavier than me, but really the only two boxers who could box well enough to push me. Both would itch to have a go. Both were fighters in the Smit tradition, and both were very tough. It called for all my ring craft to stay out of trouble. Halfway through the second round, Captain Smit would blow his whistle, and one of them would step down and the other come in. This meant each of them only boxed 1.5 rounds, and so they'd go flat out, prepared to take a few punches to get a good one in. Captain Smit was convinced that it was the only way to increase my speed and keep me sharp. After 1.5 hours in the prison gym, I'd head for Doc's cottage, where either Dee or Dum, who took it turn about, would have delivered breakfast. By the time I arrived at 8, the coffee would be made and a loaf of fresh bread would be on the table, together with eggs and bacon plopping away at the back of the stove waiting for me to arrive. Doc was, after all, still a German, and he expected me to be exactly on egg and bacon time. The girls loved the holidays and they'd spoil me rotten, with baking and fussing and generally cooking up a storm. Doc always claimed he put on several pounds when I was around. Doc and I would sit outside on his stoop for breakfast, and we'd plan the weekend hike. This usually meant repeating an old trail. Doc would bring out his notepad, and we'd discuss the last time we'd done the planned walk, which might have been 5 years before. We'd discuss every specimen we'd found then, and sometimes even leave the table to check the progress of some long-forgotten succulent we had collected. Doc was still tied to the Steinway and his little girl's students during the week, so our long walks had to take place over the weekend. Though I'm sure, after a while, he'd have had it no other way. The planning and the discussion over his notes became just as important to him as the excursions themselves. At 9 he'd give me a piano lesson, shaking his head at the bad habits I'd acquired under the direction of Mr. Mollop, the Prince of Wales School music master.
"This Mr. Mollop, you are sure he teaches pianoforte?" he would say, shaking his head. "I think maybe the banjo, yes?"
He would spend the rest of the holidays getting me back into some sort of musical shape. The first time I played St. Louis Blues for Doc, I had expected to shock him out of his pants. In fact, it was meant as a joke. Instead, he nodded quietly.
Yeah, that is good.
I turned to look at him in surprise.
But to play black, the music must come from your soul, not out of your head, Piqué.
He indicated that I should rise from piano stool, and seated in my place, he played the piece in the same haunting way as Jaime 78 of Errol Garner.
Bloody hell, Doc, where'd you learn to do that?
It was the first time I'd sworn in Doc's presence, but he seemed not to notice.
Okie dokie, Mr. Schmattypants. Who is a person called W.C. Handy?
He sounds like a lavatory brush, I said flippantly.
Mr. W.C. Handy wrote this music. And now you want to play it without heart and without even knowing who's the composer. Would you do this to Beethoven or Bach? No, I think not. But now Mr. Schmattypants thinks to play the black man's music is easy.
Sorry, Doc, it was only a joke. I only wanted to shock you.
Then to shock me, you must play me bad music. Not play me good music badly, he said softly.
I was the one who had been shocked, and Doc had in the process taught me once again to do my research and my thinking before I did my judging.
Where'd you learn to play like that, Doc?
Doc laughed.
So long ago, yeah? When I write my first book on cactus in North America, I was in New Orleans. I had no money, so I played 15 minutes classical every night in a fancy cat house, the Golden Slipper. Yeah, this is the name of that place. After I play, comes every night a jazz band. And soon we talk, and so on, and so forth. And they think the German professor is very funny, but not my music. The rich people who come to this cat house, they don't understand Mr. Beethoven and Chopin and Brahms. But the black men, they understood. I teach them a little of this and a little of that, and they teach me a little of that and a little of this.
He touched the keys and played a couple of bars of blues music.
It was here I meet Mr. W.C. Handy, and later also Mr. Willie Smith.
You met Willie Smith? I yelled at him.
The Willie Smith?
Yeah, I think there's only one.
Doc, please, please, teach me how to play jazz piano. Doc laughed, and affecting his version of an American accent, replied,
Not on your sweet tut Nelly, Piquet.
Please, Doc.
He shook his head.
I cannot teach you what I cannot feel, Piquet. You must understand this. It is not possible for a man to touch the heart of the Negro man's music when he cannot feel it through his fingers.
Doc had just explained to me why I would never amount to much musically. What Gil Pete knew I had as a boxer, Doc knew I lacked as a musician. I would leave Doc at 11 o'clock, and by 15:15 I had arrived at Miss Bornstein's house. Mr. Bornstein, who, as I mentioned before, was a lawyer in partnership with Mr. Andrews, had a big white double-story house designed in the Cape Dutch style. A huge bougainvillea creeper cascaded purple bloom over one side of the house, its mass of purple blossoms stark and beautiful against the wall, so gleaming white that it hurt to look at it in the near-noon sun. The next impression the eye met was of the sweeping lawns, which smelt of cut grass, and never seemed to lose their wet green look, even in the late summer, when every other lawn seemed strawed and faded from the heat. There were other things in the garden, trees and tropical shrubs, and a bed of deep red canna, and of course all the usual junk like roses and things. But all I seem to remember is the dramatic splash of the deep purple bougainvillea against the blinding white of the house, the green, perfectly manicured lawns, and the chit-chit-chit of the hose, spitting stingy jets of water somewhere in the garden. I'd spend the first half hour, or less, depending only on whether I could hold out that long, playing a game of chess with old Mr. Bornstein. He would always checkmate me with the same words.
Not so shameful. Tomorrow, maybe, if God spares us, you will win.
God spared us, but I never won. A houseboy in a white starched coat would then bring me a glass of milk and 2 chocolate biscuits, my favorite. Then the lesson would begin. We'd work until 2 o'clock, when the same boy brought in a jug of orange juice and a plate of bologna and tomato sandwiches, also my favourite. Miss Bornstein was determined that I should win a Rhodes Scholarship and go to Oxford, and the work we did was far in excess of anything I needed to know to pass my matriculation. With her pushing me, particularly in Latin and Greek, by weekly letter and during the school holidays, and with the tuition reserved for St. John's people, I was probably getting as fine an education as it was possible for anyone of my age to absorb. After orange juice and sandwiches, I was free. Some days I'd spend the afternoon with Mrs. Boxall, or help Grandpa in the garden, or play a little snooker down at the Impala Hotel with John Hopkins and Jeffrey Scrooby, and some of the other guys, all of whom, like me, were going to boarding school. They'd drink a couple of beers and smoke a little, and we'd all generally act a bit tough with each other, though I was always in training and neither smoked nor drank. I was beginning to understand how intellect separates men. For common ground, we would talk rugby and cricket and girls. Daily, we destroyed the reputations of the girls who'd been in class with us in primary school, and who were now supposedly screwing like rattlesnakes. We never quite worked out with whom. It was always supposed to be someone older than ourselves, like Paul Everingham and Bob Goodhead, who were in Form 6 at Jeppy High, and both had their school colours for rugby and cricket. Puberty had taken a fierce and urgent grip on all of us, so that the fantasy of fucking was never more than an unuttered sentence away. But my mind, when it wasn't on sex, was different. I guess it always had been. But now the dichotomy was beginning to show. I didn't feel superior. There was nothing to be superior about. My mind simply seemed to gaze over different intellectual landscapes. I dare say, had I not been a boxer and rugby player, and greatly respected for the former, the rest of the chaps in Barberton would have dismissed me as a brain and a bit of a loner. I found Doc, Mrs. Boxall, Miss Bornstein, and old Mr. Bornstein a source of stimulation. But the adult mind has lost much of its craziness, its zany quality, and I missed the verbal jousting that Jaime supplied in our day-to-day relationship at school. In fact, when I got back to school after the holidays, it would take me a couple of days to get my verbal riposte sharp and my timing right again. "Christ, PK, your brain's addled by too much deep and meaningful discussion about the weather and the crops and whether the locusts will come again this year," Jaime would tease. Atherton and Pissy and Cunning Spider also shared an intelligence which would readily mix into a really good verbal over an abstract point simply for the love of argument itself. Jaime would contend that anything, no matter how banal, could be raised to the level of intelligent debate if the minds which attended to it were good enough. He told the story of the little cobbler in a shtetl in Russia, who was spreading honey on a piece of bread when the bread fell to the floor. To his amazement, the bread fell right side up. "How can this be?" he said, and with the slice of bread in his hand, he ran to consult the rabbi and the village elders. "We are Jews in Russia. How can it be that I spread honey on my bread, and when it fell to the floor, it landed right side up? Since when did luck such as this come to a Jew?" The rabbi and the elders pondered the point for several days, consulting the Torah frequently. Finally, they called the little cobbler to the synagogue. The rabbi pronounced the verdict. "The answer, my boy, is quite clear. You honeyed your bread on the wrong side." We had all cawed and moaned at the story, but Jaime, as usual, had made his point. Good conversational debate was an end in itself, and talking for the love of conversation is what makes us human. That Easter holiday, Doc and I had planned an overnight hike to a waterfall we knew about some 12 miles past Saddleback Pass. As waterfalls go, it wasn't a major one, but it tumbled down through an area of rainforest, which in our only previous visit we'd come across too late to explore properly. The cliffs rising above the forest looked interesting, and Doc was sure we'd find succulents and several species of dwarf aloe in the rocky crags and ledges. I'd been concerned when Doc had suggested the hike. It was a good 20 miles across the mountains, and Doc was over 80. Just how far over, no one knew. And while he was as lean as a twist of licorice and tough as a mountain goat, it was a hard day's march by any standards. And in the notes he had made on our previous trip nearly 8 years earlier, he'd noted that the hike had been an exhausting one. He had answered my protests with typical Doc logic.
"PK, if not now, it will be never again. Our work here is unfinished. The topography, see, I have made a drawing here in my notes, suggests limestone in the cliffs.
If this is true, it is rare, almost impossible. Some geological freak happenings, maybe. Doc knew he'd stirred my need for adventure, and the prospect of finding something that shouldn't be there allowed me to brush my concern aside and agree that we should undertake the trip. Doc had managed to postpone his little girls for Friday, and we set out at dawn with our blanket rolls, billy cans, and enough food for 2 days, as well as a hurricane lamp, Doc's 8-battery ever-ready torch, rope, a small hammer, and a dozen homemade metal spikes, hooked at the ends to secure the rope if necessary. Gert had made these for Doc in the prison metal shop soon after he'd left prison, and they'd been invaluable for scrambling up rock faces, now that Doc wasn't as young a mountain goat as he pretended to be. By the time the sun rose over the escarpment and filled the Takarp Valley, we had climbed the foothills and were into the mountains proper. The aloe and thorn scrub were replaced by scree and tussock grass, turning to rocky crags where the wind can be cold even on a hot day. We often saw an eagle high above us, seemingly drifting without purpose, carried by the currents of air. With a stop for lunch of cheese and cream crackers, washed down by a billy of sweet black tea, we crossed Saddleback Pass in the early afternoon and started the climb down the other side. By late afternoon we'd reached the peculiar formation of mountain cliffs, rising above the deep kloof of rainforest Doc had noted in his diary. We made camp beside a mountain brook, flowing from the waterfall, which dropped like a bridal veil down the far edge of the cliffs above us. I had chosen our campsite on the edge of the rainforest, where an overhanging rock protected us from the wind. It can get bitterly cold during the night in the mountains, and we set about collecting firewood before we lost the light. High above us, we first heard and then saw a troop of baboons climbing the strange cliff face, and running along the white ledges eroded into the face of the rock. Their urgent barking echoed down into the kloof where we'd made our camp. Doc put his field glasses onto the cliff. "It's too much shadow now. But I think tomorrow we find up there for sure something." Darkness comes quickly in the mountains, and less than an hour after we'd arrived, the sun had set, throwing the deep kloof into shadow. Even though there was still some light, I got the fire for supper going, the dry branches crackling and popping with plenty of smoke to ward off the mosquitoes, which always seemed to come from nowhere moments after sunset. I set about making our supper, while Doc washed at the stream. Chopping an onion and 2 tomatoes into a billy can, I then upended a can of bully beef into the billy, mashing it all together with my hunting knife, ready for when the fire would glow down so that it would cook slowly. I'd already trapped 2 large sweet potatoes under the unmade fire, so that we'd be able to pluck them out of the cooking embers later for dessert. The rainforest grew dark first. The clear outlines of the giant tree ferns smudged and then blackened into darkness, while high up in a yellow wood tree a couple of green lurys called out one last time before they called it a day. Next, the valley on the edge of the forest where we'd camped dimmed down for the night, closing out the light, blurring rock and bush and tree. Finally, the sky on the high ridge above us pulled a dark sheet over us and pinned it with stars. The distant sound of falling water from the falls seemed to emphasize the silence. Doc spoke quietly in the night. "No one has written a great symphony or even a concerto about Africa. Why is this so?" He hadn't expected an answer, and I waited for him to continue. "The music of Africa is too wild, too free, too accustomed to death for romance. Africa's too crude a stage for the small scratching of the violin, too majestic for the piano. Africa is only right for drums. The drum carries its rhythm, but does not steal its music. Timpani is the background. The music of Africa is in the voices of the people. They're its instruments, more subtle, more beautiful, infinitely more noble than the scratching, thumping, banging and blowing of brass and wind and vellum, strings and keyboard." "What about Requiem for Gil Piet?" I asked. Doc chuckled. "For 20 years I have tried to compose 10 or even 5 minutes of music, good music, for the great Southland. And then after 20 years of failure, I find it in the chain gangs, in the rhythm of a pick, and the sweat of black backs and the vicious crack of the shambok, and the almost noiseless thud of the donkey prick. The voice music is not the keening of despair, but the expression of a certainty that Africa will live, and the spirit will survive brutality. The music of Africa is in the soul, and its instruments are in the voices of the people. Such a domkop, PK. All the time it is waiting absolutely under my long German nose. Requiem for Heel Pete is not my music. It is the music of the people. The necklace is only mine because I strung the beads. I handed Doc a steaming plate of bully beef. Then, using a short stick, I rolled the two sweet potatoes from the embers to cook a little for later. We ate in silence. Doc never took food for granted, and would chew for ages before swallowing. I added a couple of logs to build the fire up again, and then walked down to the stream to wash the plates and fill the billy. After I'd made coffee, and poured a tablespoon of condensed milk into the tin mug just the way Doc liked it, I placed the steaming cup next to him and sliced open his sweet potato. Steam rose from its fat, succulent belly, and to this too I added condensed milk as a special treat. The mosquitoes, kept at bay by the early smoke from the fire, were out in force again. I rubbed citronella oil over my arms and legs and handed the bottle to Doc. The oil smelt pretty bad, but it was a damn sight better than being bitten after death. We'd been going since 4:15 in the morning and were exhausted. Too tired to wash the mugs, I wrapped myself in my blanket. Checking first to see that Doc lay well clear of the fire, I curled up under the overhang of the rock, so that my blanket wouldn't be wet with dew in the morning, and went to sleep. I woke at dawn, and keeping my blanket wrapped around me, I built up the fire again. The valley was shrouded in mist, and the rainforest, which began not 20 yards from our campsite, was invisible. Minutes after the sun hit the valley, the mist would vanish, but until it did, the cold would remain. My hands were freezing as I filled the billy from the stream for coffee. Doc was snoring again, tightly wrapped in his blanket, and I let him sleep on until I'd made his coffee and blown a generous tablespoon's worth of condensed milk into it. I did the same for myself, and the steaming mug soon warmed my hands. I didn't wake Doc. I knew the smell of the fresh-brewed coffee would do that for me. Doc loved coffee more than I think he loved his cactus garden, and almost as much as Beethoven and J.S. Bach. Pretty soon his nostrils began to twitch, and grunting to himself, he sat up in the blanket and knuckled his eyes open. High up through the mist, we could hear the barking of the baboons. The sun must have reached them, and they were moving on. Doc gripped the mug I gave him in both hands. Then, looking up in the direction of the cliffs invisible above him in the mist, he said, "Today will be different, Piquet." The barking of the baboons echoed down the misty valley. "Yeah, for sure and absolutely. Today we find something." Taking a careful sip of coffee, "I hope you sleep good, Piquet," he asked. I cooked two sausages and a couple of rashers of bacon and then split the sausages down the center and laid them on two slices of bread, topped them with bacon and sandwiched them with two more thick slices of bread. I handed one of the crude sandwiches to Doc and ate the other myself, holding it to my mouth with both hands. While we were having a second cup of coffee, the sun was beginning to dazzle its way through the mist, and seemingly in minutes the valley was filled with sunshine. A few patches of mist hung near the floor of the rainforest, but they too were soon gone. Above us, the strange-looking cliffs looked less foreboding in the bright morning light, and I scanned them to see how we might set about the climb. In a mist-shrouded landscape, sounds are always exaggerated. Now, with the mist gone, the morning settled down into all its reassuring components, the chatter of birds, running water, the urgent whir of a grasshopper, and in fact the generally busy noises of the mountain day coming fully to life. I walked over to a small clump of bushes and was in the half-squat position with my pants around my ankles when two plump bush partridges whirred from the underbrush directly beside me. I rose, my pants still around my ankles, and squinting down the barrel of an imaginary shotgun, I let them have it, first with the left and then pulling carefully around to get the second bird with the right barrel. I then watched laughing as they disappeared, like a couple of hurricane fighters, over a small ridge beyond me. After washing, I cleaned up camp and stowed our stuff under the overhanging rock, sprinkling our blanket rolls with citronella oil. If anything approached, particularly a scorpion looking for a nice warm place to nestle, the unfamiliar smell of the oil would drive it away. Doc slung the rope around his neck and hung his 8-battery ever-ready torch from his belt. I took a small climber's rucksack with water bottle, trowel for digging footholds, hammer, metal spikes, paraffin lamp, and Doc's field glasses. The climb didn't look too bad. Buttresses of rock led to the long ridges eroded into the face of the rock, as though the cliff face itself were made from a composition of hard and soft rock. It was these seemingly soft, white striations of rock which had first caught Doc's interest, and which he was pretty sure would be dolomite or some sort of limestone. The torch and the paraffin lamp were a giveaway. Doc, always a romantic, was hoping we'd find a cave in the cliff face, a prospect which naturally appealed to me enormously. We climbed for an hour, but going not too hard. Doc, despite his age, was a skilled mountaineer who took no chances, and whereas I might have made it to the first ridge of eroded rock perhaps 100 foot from the ground in half the time it took us, our progress was sure, and the way back carefully mapped out in our minds. Getting down a steep face can often be more difficult than getting up it. The first ridge of eroded rock proved Doc's theory to be right. The material was dolomite, which had been worn away by tens of thousands of years of wind and rain to make deep ledges with overhangs cut into the cliff face. We followed the ledge until we found a way back onto the cliff face and continued to climb. It took us another hour to get another 100 feet up the cliff to yet another ledge. This one, more exposed to the wind, had been cut deeper into the rock, and we could smell where the baboons had settled for the night. Another 50 feet up the face, and we came to a third ridge, deeper yet again. Walking along this ridge, we found it gouged deeper and deeper into the cliff face, until it came to a sudden end. We'd reached a blind alley. There seemed to be no way of getting back onto the face so that we could climb higher. By now we'd been going almost 3 hours, and the sun, beating onto the face of the cliff, was hot. Doc's khaki shirt was wet with perspiration, and I suggested we sit down for a drink and a rest. The ridge we were sitting on was, I judged, about 100 feet from the top of the cliff, but it appeared impossible to go any further. Down below us we could see the canopy of the rainforest, with one old yellow wood tree, its branches stretching clear to the sky, 50 feet above the canopy of the forest, and no more than 100 feet below where we were sitting. Doc said it could well be 1,000 years old. The cliff face was shaped in a wide arc, and on our right, about 100 feet below us, a waterfall gushed from the rock face. More a fine misty spray than a gush, really, but sufficient to feed the stream we'd camped beside. Doc took his notebook from the rucksack and turned to a crude sketch he'd made of the cliff from the ground level the previous afternoon. Yeah. We are sitting now in the deepest ledge. Above is harder rock and not so deep striations. He sighed, clearly puzzled. Doc didn't like to be wrong about his observations, which he would only have permitted himself to voice after a great deal of careful consideration. Well, PK, we found dolomite and also there's water, but no cave. This is very strange. You can see the waterfall comes straight from the cliff. The stream must run deep inside the face of the cliff. There should be caves. Yeah, this is so, absolutely. I walked back to the wall at the end of the ledge and peeked over the edge, hoping to find a small ledge which would take us further across the face. About 3 feet below me, a small ridge of rock, no more than 6 inches wide, ran for 2 or 3 yards and then took a slight turn so I was unable to see where it continued. I swung my body over the edge of the ledge, dangling my feet until they reached the narrow ridge of rock. With my stomach against the cliff, I edged my way along it. I'd hardly moved more than 3 feet when I found myself looking directly into a hole in the cliff, about 2 feet wide and 3 feet high. I was able to look some 10 feet down the tunnel before it turned to darkness. It was quite clearly an entrance to a cave, and not simply a tunnel worn into the rock. A firebush grew from a crack in the rock to the right of the opening to conceal it from being seen from below. Suddenly a bat flew out of the tunnel, blurred past me, and I heard the unmistakable squeak of bats deep in the rock face. I was certain I had found a cave. "I found it! We found our cave!" I yelled. My voice, hugely magnified, echoed down the valley. It would take very little effort to lift myself up into the hole, but holes have a habit of containing surprises infinitely worse than a few hundred harmless bats. So I edged back to where Doc was waiting. Helping me back up onto the ledge, Doc too was excited.
"So, I am right, PK,"
he said triumphantly. I explained that if we could secure a rope handrail, it would be possible for him to follow me into the cave. We discussed a way of doing this for some time. Then, hammering a couple of spikes into the floor of the ledge, we secured one end of the rope through the eyes of the spikes, both of us pulling on the rope to make sure the spikes were firmly bedded into the rock. Next, we tied the rope to my waist, and I tucked three spikes, the hammer and Doc's torch, into the back of my belt, where I could reach back and get them comfortably. Doc paid out the rope as I slid backwards, down onto the thin lip of rock below the ledge. Had I fallen, it was unlikely Doc would have been able to haul me back again. But I was very sure on my feet and unconcerned by heights. In less than 30 seconds, I was in front of the cave entrance. I lifted myself through the hole with comparative ease, and commenced to crawl along the narrow tunnel, which continued in a slightly upward direction for about 20 feet, then widened out. I untied the rope from around my waist and removed the long silver torch from my belt. The daylight had disappeared by the time I'd crawled to the end of the tunnel, so I switched on the powerful Ever-Ready, to find that the tunnel led into a cave, which appeared to be about 15 feet long and equally wide, while being high enough for me to stand upright. The cave smelt powerfully of baboon and bats. As I played the torch around the walls, I could see hundreds of bats hanging from the roof and the walls. I returned down the narrow passage to the cliff face, and sticking my head out, yelled at Doc that I'd found a big cave. My voice echoed down the valley, as the barking of the baboons had done the previous evening, and again that morning.
"It's not too hard, Doc. I'll hammer a couple of spikes into the tunnel wall, and tie the rope, and you can use it as a handrail to come across."
I set about this task, drawing the rope tight so that it made a firm handrail from the ledge into the mouth of the tunnel. Doc was a fearless old coot, and dropping himself backwards onto the rock ridge and holding the rope, he quickly edged across the cliff face to the mouth of the tunnel. I pulled him in, and now he was lying on his belly looking into the dark tunnel.
"Wunderbar, PK. A cave. How big? A big one, yes?" he panted.
"You'll have to crawl. It's slightly upwards. Follow the torch. It's only about 20 feet in." The cave was not high enough for Doc to stand upright, so he squatted, holding the torch while I lit the hurricane lamp, which he'd brought with him in the rucksack strapped to his back. I placed the lamp in the middle of the cave, where it threw a dim but adequate light, and Doc started to examine the walls with a torch beam. The floor was covered with bat shit.
"It should smell worse than this."
Doc took out a box of matches and struck one on the side of his pants. The match flared, momentarily lighting his face.
"A wind. In here's a wind. From someplace else there's coming a wind."
Doc was right. The flame from the match was flickering and then went out. He shone his torch into the left corner of the cave, where a sharp buttress of rock protruded. The torchlight played on the rock, and as Doc swept the beam to the top of the buttress, the light disappeared into a void. We realized that there was an opening beyond it, from which came the unmistakable sound of water dripping. We both moved round the back of the rock to discover the opening about 4 feet above the ground, which reached to the ceiling. Doc lit the opening for me to scramble through, and he passed the lantern to me and then the torch before following. As he dropped to the ground, I swung the powerful torch into the black void.
"Holy Malensky!"
The torch showed a huge chamber, from the floor and the ceiling of which grew stalactite and stalagmite. The roof of the cave must have been at least 40 feet high, and the snowy-white calcareous structures falling from it, some of which had reached the ground, looked like an illustration from a child's fairy tale. Pools of infinitely still water on parts of the cave floor mirrored the grotesque shapes, creating an enchanted world which appeared to be carved in crystal. I handed the torch back to Doc, and took up the lantern as we moved forward to explore. Doc kept stopping to train his torch on one or another of the beautiful crystal columns.
"Absolut. Absolut wunderbar,"
he kept repeating. It was certainly the most amazing natural phenomenon I had ever witnessed, and I followed Doc as we explored the huge chamber. We found several fissures in the walls, none of which were wide enough to climb through. We traced the source of the water to a point high in the ceiling, from which a constant drip of water fell. Doc pointed out that this drip was too rapid for the formation of stalactites. The gradual movement of water seeping through rock collects a load of calcium carbonate. When it finally squeezes through to the ceiling of the cave and reaches the air, it sheds its load of calcium carbonate and an infinitely small part of a stalactite is formed. Each drop adds its minute contribution. He pointed to a massive stalactite to our right.
Perhaps 300,000 years, maybe more.
Doc's voice was filled with awe. On the far wall, some 60 feet into the cave, a ledge of rock protruded about 15 feet from the floor. Above it hung huge spikes of stalactite and clumps of glittering crystals, while directly under the ledge, like grotesque legs to a giant table, stalagmites had grown. A buttress of crystal stalagmite had grown to one side of the platform to resemble steps leading up to it. So the entire effect was like a magnificent slab held high by crystal shafts with huge spikes of crystallized light suspended above it.
Look, Doc. It's like Merlin's altar in the crystal cave.
Doc sucked in his breath.
Yeah. In such a place went Merlin for sure.
He pointed to the throne.
To lie on this altar and in 150,000 years, maybe the body would be a part of this cave. A part of the crystal cave of Africa. Imagine only this, Piquet.
I grinned. Can you hold off for a while, please, Doc? I still need you here. The thought of Doc dying had never entered my head. I often thought of him growing old, unable to do the things we'd done in the past. But I never thought of him as disappearing, not being there, not being a part of my life. I understood death. It happened at any time. It was a brutal accident, like the death of Grandpa Chuck or Heel Pete, or Big Hetty's flyweight. Even Big Hetty's death could be explained in that she was freakishly big and thus fell into the category of unexpected death. Doc did not fall into any of the criteria I had set aside in my mind for death. Doc was calm and reason and order, and the kind of death I knew had no part in the expectations for our relationship. He had walked ahead up to the crystal-like speleothems which formed the steps to the platform. Climbing these, his boots made a scrunching noise on the hard calcium deposits, and soon he stood on the platform. Suddenly, without warning, he squatted and then stretched out full length so that his body was lost from my sight.
"Oh, come on, Doc, that's not funny,"
I said, suddenly a little scared. Doc's torch shone upwards, lighting the stalactites falling from the ceiling above him, so that they looked like crystal bolts of lightning frozen in place above him. It was the most frightening and magnificent effect I have ever seen. Doc's voice came back to me, sounding serene.
"It is beautiful, PK. We must never tell any person about the crystal cave of Africa."
"Come on, Doc, you're giving me the creeps," I answered, not fully taking in what he had said. Doc stood up, shining the torch straight into my eyes so that I was blinded by the light.
"You must promise me, PK. It is very important. You must promise, please."
He withdrew the torch from my face, and in the fuzziness the temporary blinding had created, he looked just like Merlin, standing between huge spikes of crystal on the platform 10 feet above me.
"Doc, please come down. I promise. Now please come down."
"Yeah, I come. Remember, you have promised, Piquet."
He made his way down from the platform carefully, and I ran to give him a hand. He was breathing heavily, and as I helped him down, I could feel the excitement in the old man. We made our way back to the Bat Cave, and Doc shone the Ever-Ready back into the chamber.
"Piquet, we have found a place in Africa no man has ever seen. The purest magic cave. The Crystal Cave of Africa."
"Come on, Doc, let's skedaddle. What's the time?" He fished into his trouser pocket for his hunter and shone the torch on its face.
10:30, he said.
Doc always told the time in this funny manner. "We've got to go. If we get back to camp by noon, it'll be dark by the time we get home." Fortunately, most of the way home was downhill, and we knew we would gain a couple of hours on the way back. I calculated it would be around 8 that evening before we would be home. Walking the foothills in the dark wouldn't be much fun, and Doc would be exhausted. My anxiety to get going had taken the edge off my excitement. Doc grabbed me by the arm. He was still shaking.
"Remember, PK, this is our cave. The Crystal Cave belongs only to you and to me."
"Okay, Doc, I promise. I already promised. Now let's get the hell out of here."
It wasn't at all like Doc to be so insistent. Anyway, he knew he could trust me implicitly. The cave had had a tremendous effect on him, and I knew he'd want us to come back, though I doubted that he'd be able to make such a tough climb for much longer. I'd cut the rope we'd taken into the cave, but had left the rope handrail intact for Dr. Yu's getting out. Once we were back on the ledge, I began to retrieve the two metal spikes, as we'd already lost two by having to leave them embedded in the tunnel wall.
"No, leave them, PK," Doc said suddenly. "There's no time."
It was unlike Doc, who was always very careful about equipment. We'd account for everything before moving on from a campsite or where we had been collecting specimens. It was the first time he had ever been devious, and I realized how emotionally charged he had become over the Crystal Cave. The old bugger was determined to come back. We arrived back in the foothills above the town, just as a giant moon was coming up over the escarpment, flooding the Dakarp Valley in silver light. It was a full moon again, and that was always a difficult time for me. It had been a full moon when Grandpa Chook died, and while the memory of that funny old rooster had dimmed, when the moon was full, memories came galloping through the silver night to sadden me. It had also been a full moon when Giel Piet had died. I was right. This would be the last big trek with Doc, who was at the point of collapse by the time we finally reached his cottage. I laid him on top of his bed and removed his boots. He had two large blisters, one under each big toe, so I threaded a needle in cotton and ran a loop of cotton through each blister, which I then tied, leaving them overnight to drain the fluid. It was a technique Doc had shown me years before, and I knew that by morning the blisters would have flattened and there would be no pain. I washed his face and put Vaseline over a cut under his eye and threw an army blanket over him. He was a tough old blighter, and in the morning I was pretty sure he'd be okay.
"Ours, the Crystal Cave, Africa. You, me, PK," he mumbled, and then seemed to drift off into sleep. I waited until his breathing was deep and even before leaving for home.
On the way, the moon was so bright that one could see the purple blossom of the jacaranda trees. I was saddened at the thought of never again being with him in the high mountains. Each time I came back from school, Doc seemed a little more frail. We had found the Crystal Cave of Africa, but would I see it only once? Perhaps I would return, perhaps not. When you share things, as Doc and I had done, somehow it seemed wrong to halve the secret by returning alone. I thought of the rope rotting, and perhaps in 100 years they'd find the holes where the spikes had long since rusted out, and observe the rust stains in the dolomite. They'd search and find minute metal fragments which they'd analyze, and then propound all sorts of theories that would have nothing to do with a 6-foot-7-inch German professor of music and the future welterweight boxing champion of the world. 20. The second term of Form 3 began with a new aspect of school life. St. John Byrne's tutorials 3 times a week were quite unlike school. We talked for an hour, and from it would come at least 3 hours of reading and preparation for the next tutorial. The headmaster had a wide grasp of subject, and he was quick to discover where a boy's special aptitudes lay. These he would cultivate carefully, while at the same time balancing the mental menu with the discipline of tackling subjects which, though less interesting, he thought essential to a well-rounded education. St. John's people seldom met as a group, and once chosen they were never mentioned again in the activity of the Prince of Wales School. No attempt was ever made to make any one of us seem special or especially important, although a powerful struggle between the 6 took place in the normal course of school, with each one of St. John's people competing fiercely in the classroom for honours. All this, combined with boxing and rugby football, left me very little time to myself. Jaime had also revealed his big plan. By now he was so intimately involved with me as a boxer as well as a friend that he acted quite unselfconsciously as my manager. In 2 and a bit years, Jaime had acquired remarkable expertise on boxing, and he too was aware that we'd reached the limitations of both Darby White and Sarge, and needed to take the next step in my training. "Who's the best professional boxing trainer in South Africa?" he'd asked one afternoon shortly after our return to school. "You already know the answer to that. Solly Goldman." "Well, I went to see him during the holidays. We're working out for him when he gets back from a trip to England in 6 weeks. If he likes what he sees, he'll take you on." "Jesus, Jaime, that's wonderful. How'd you get him to agree? Solly Goldman only handles professionals." For once, Jaime wasn't ready with a flip answer. He looked down at the back of his hands as he answered. "We're going to pay him. We've got enough money in the bank to pay him for a year, and then we'll think of something else." Jaime looked up at me. "Now I know what you're going to say, but as far as I'm concerned, my money is yours. You'd do the same for me." "It's not on, Jaime. Thank you, but it's simply not on. There are two reasons. The first you already know about. No handouts. Not under any circumstances. Friendship notwithstanding. The second is more practical. That's our business capital. The first rule of business is never to eat into your capital. You above all people know that." "Look, we can still keep the bank. I can borrow money from my old man to keep the float going. You don't have to take a handout. You can buy back your share of the float capital from the profits. And you can take a salary as pocket money. You'll see, it'll work out." "Jaime, there's nothing in the world I want more than Solly Goldman's expertise, but I can't do it. It's got something to do with an incident in my life when I was 5 years old, and I've promised myself I would never again forfeit my independence, never again find myself in a position where I wasn't in control of my life." Jaime looked hurt, and I couldn't blame him. In a sense, I was rejecting his friendship and his trust. But the wounds entrenched by the judge and Nazi stormtroopers had left adhesions on my psyche as a constant reminder to me that I was on my own. "Okay, PK, have it your way, man." Then Jaime grinned. "If I think up a scam and your share makes enough money to pay Goldman, will you be in it?" I grinned, relieved that he had accepted my objection. "That's business, that's different. But only if I play my part and the whole thing's kosher." "Shake a paw, partner," Jaime grinned. "This one is going to be an intellectual masterpiece." Atherton, Cunning Spider and I had been a combination on the rugby field from Form 1. I was a natural scrum half, with Atherton following in the footsteps of his famous cousin, developing into a brilliant fly half, while Cunning Spider was a centre with a lot of style. Hugh Lyle and Jean Minard, both St. John's people, were also on the team. While I was still technically under 14, I elected to play in the under-15 team to keep the combination together. Pissy Johnson, who seemed to grow bigger every term, was a front-row forward, and of course Jaime only became interested because most of the wooden spoon goons were in the team. The under-15 team in any school is the nursery for the first 15, and so the players in it are always carefully watched by the rugby masters, who regarded this particular team as one with great promise. Jaime, as usual, analysed the teams against whom we played, and like his boxing notes, we had a pretty good idea of their game plan and capability before taking the field against them. As he had done in his SWAT spot in boxing, Jaime made us think and behave like winners. "Winners make their own luck, but winners are also lucky," he said. In the under-13s and 14s, when we had played Help Makar, the Afrikaans school where I had boxed my first bout to beat Yanni Geldenhuis, the much bigger Help Makar forwards had made mincemeat of us, and the stronger, bigger backs had run us off our feet. Geldenhuis, playing scrum half opposite me, had thoroughly enjoyed his revenge on each of these four occasions. In the last under-14 match there, they'd beaten us narrowly. As we left the field, he'd given me an unnecessarily patronizing pat on the back. "In the ring is one thing, on the rugby field is another. Rugby is more important than boxing, man." We'd met 5 times in the ring, and while he was always a tough opponent, on each occasion I'd beaten him. He had a right to try to get even. We would play each school twice during a season, and so in our personal score it was me with 5 boxing wins, Help Makar 4 rugby wins. Jaime in particular was anxious to change these rugby statistics when we met in the under-15s. While the Help Makar team was still bigger than we were, things had evened out a bit in size. Jaime was convinced that we could beat them. "Look at the statistics, PK.
In the under-13s, they beat us 20-0, and again 15-0. Last year, it was 9-0 and 10-3, and we scored a try to 2 free kicks and a drop goal. Statistically, we have to take them this year.
I had my doubts. Helpakar, with 4 wins to their credit in the preceding 2 years, had a right to be confident. Jaime, they're Boers. They'd rather die than lose to an English school. It's not simply a matter of statistics.
Yeah, I know. That's what we're going to have to fix.
On the Wednesday afternoon, 2 weeks prior to the match, when we were meant to be studying at the Johannesburg Library, Jaime drew me aside.
Will you come to help Makar with me this afternoon to see Jani Geldenhuis? Don't ask any questions, just say yes. It's important.
Sitting on the top deck of the Parktown bus, he outlined his plan.
There are nearly 1,200 kids at help Makar, and 600 at our school. If we can get most of them to place a bet on help Makar winning against our under-15s, we could really clean up. We'd have your Solly Goldman money.
Christ, Jaime, we're back to straight gambling. You're crazy. This isn't like those first boxing matches when we took a few bets in the toilet before the fight. There I was the surprise factor in that scam. The punters from the other schools didn't know we had a boxer who could fight. This is just the opposite. They know how good we are, and what's more, we've never beaten them. This whole thing contradicts our business philosophy. You know what your problem is, PK? You worry too much. With you as a friend, that's hardly bloody surprising. I hope you've got a plan. Jaime opened his hands expansively. Does a bird fly? Of course I've got a plan, but I may have to tap dance a little when we get there, so please excuse me if I don't explain it to you in detail. But I promise you, our business philosophy is intact.
Jaime, listen.
Picking up a dozen punters in the shithouse is one thing. Taking on a whole bloody Afrikaans school is another. You don't know these buggers like I do. These guys don't gamble. The Afrikaans are very religious, you know.
Greed, my dear Piquet, transcends religion.
Did not the Roman soldiers gamble for Christ's garments at Golgotha? Besides, when those help Makar guys see the odds I'm offering, their little Boer hands won't be able to get a kitchen knife to their money boxes fast enough.
Jaime, I hope this whole thing's kosher. If it turns out to be a con, and they find out, we're dead meat.
Jaime had taught us all the Jewish word kosher, and it had become the generic term for something being legitimate. Jaime smiled.
I've racked my brains. In fact, I'm rather ashamed of myself, but even with my considerable intellect, there is no way of ensuring the outcome, other than to pay them off, which is patently impossible. You simply have to beat them on the day. Believe me, it's as kosher as my grandma's chicken soup.
He turned to me and gave me his most disarming smile.
Piquet, I know you've got a considerable rep with these Boers. No way I'm going to spoil that.
You're the only Roenick Christian gentleman they respect. He paused.
Just get it into your head that we can beat the bastards.
I hope you didn't mean you'd pay them off if you could find a way.
No, of course not. I was only kidding. The nicest part of a scam is the brains part. Anyone can learn to cheat.
We reached the top of the hill and arrived at Hope Makar gates just as school was getting out. A sea of brown blazers piped with yellow braid engulfed our 2 green ones. Remarks were flying left, right and centre, and things were getting decidedly uncomfortable.
What now?
I whispered to Jaime.
We just wait here, you'll see,
he replied. Just then a voice cut through the sea of brown blazers.
Piquet, how's it?
It was Jani Geldenhuis.
Sorry I'm late, man. I had to see one of the masters. Come with me.
He extended his hand in the Boer manner, and we shook it in turn, and then followed him through the gates.
Machtig, I thought you were going to be lynched, I said to Jani in Afrikaans. No way, man. They all know you're here. You are sort of a hero.
We had reached the school toilets, where a couple of guys about our own age were having a quiet smoke. Jani asked them politely to leave, and they kicked at the ground with the toe cap of their shoes, then decided to obey, killed their cigarettes by pinching the heads off, and put the unused stompies in their blazer pockets for use later. Jaime said he'd accept odds of 3-1 on the Prince of Wales school winning. Geldenhuis gasped,
"You're crazy, man! We already beat you 4-0!
Those are the odds, Jaime said quietly.
That's bloody terrific for the punters, Geldenhuis said. But what about us? You'll be cleaned out. 15% of nothing is nothing. and I'll end up with my arse kicked by 1,200 bloody angry help Macar punters.
Helenus was not just a pretty face, I observed. Haim had gone crackers. Help Macar had to be favoured to win. 3-1 odds was suicide.
Okay, Heldenhuis. PK and I will give you a written guarantee that we'll honour our debts if the Prince of Wales loses.
He reached into the inside pocket of his blazer and handed me a square of folded paper. I opened it to see that it was a guarantee by the bank to pay in the event of a Help Macar win. There was a place at the bottom for two signatures. Jaime had already signed as one of them.
"Sign it and give it to him," Jaime said casually.
I made a rough calculation in my head. Assuming 2/3 of the punters bet against us at an average of 2 shillings a bet, we stood to lose around £370. If we sold the bank to a syndicate and our rights to Miss Bornstein's famous correspondence school notes and took all our savings, we could just make it. I breathed a sigh of relief. If it had been more than our total assets, I would have had to turn Jaime down in front of Heldenhuis, causing us both no end of embarrassment. I borrowed Jaime's Parker 51, and holding the guarantee against the toilet wall, I signed it. But I can tell you I was not happy. Jaime Solomon Levy was going to be in a lot of shit when we were alone again. Heldenhuis took the guarantee from me, read it, and pulled out a small leather wallet from his pocket. As he opened it to stow the guarantee, I noticed it contained no money.
"Okay, Heldenhuis. 20% of the winnings or 50 quid now, it's your choice," Jaime said.
Like me before Jaime had entered my life, Jani Heldenhuis had probably never seen a £10 note in his life, much less 50. £8 a week was the average white worker's wage. Help Macar was not a private school, and his parents were probably battling to make ends meet. Jaime had read his man correctly.
"I'll take the £50 now," Heldenhuis said.
Jani Heldenhuis must have believed we couldn't win. Jaime was offering him 50 quid against a potential of 75. Jaime pulled out his wallet and opened it.
"Just a second," Heldenhuis said suddenly.
He withdrew his wallet again and took the guarantee from it and proffered it to Jaime.
"I got a condition of my own. Without it, we got no deal, man."
We both looked at Heldenhuis with surprise.
"What's the condition, Jani?" I asked.
"Well, first of all, I'm only agreeing to set up the Help Macar side of the betting because you're in this PK."
He jabbed his finger in Jaime's direction.
"I don't do business with a Jew boy."
"Hey, now wait a minute." I was suddenly angry. "Jaime and I are in this together. No Jaime, no deal." I turned to Jaime. "Come on, let's piss off." Jaime put his hand up in a conciliatory manner.
"Now hang on a second. Take it easy. We're a partnership. If Jani here wants to deal with you, that's fine."
He had moved so as to unsight Heldenhuis and gave me a knowing wink, then turned again so that Heldenhuis could see him, and removed 5 £10 notes from his wallet.
"Here, PK, you pay the man."
Before I could take the money, Heldenhuis said,
"That's not the condition."
The beginnings of a smile played at the corners of his mouth. I was still angry.
"So what's the condition, Heldenhuis?"
"Fight me."
He must have seen the surprise on my face.
"What, here, now?"
"I just turned featherweight. You're still easier bantamweight. I want a last chance to get even."
"And if he says no?" Jaime asked.
Still looking directly at me, Heldenhuis said,
"No deal. You can stick your 50 quid up your Jew boy arse. What do you reckon, PK? Box me 3 rounds here in the gym?"
"Christ, and to think I liked you, Heldenhuis. You're on, but I haven't got any gear."
"I already thought of it. I got stuff for you."
Heldenhuis paused and then shrugged his shoulders.
"Hey, no hard feelings, man. You a roinick, I'm a boar. I won't be happy till I beat you," he said simply.
"You may be a long time unhappy, man. Where do I change?"
"Who's going to referee?" Jaime asked.
Jani Heldenhuis pointed to Witwatersrand University campus, which was only a couple of 100 yards from the school. We got the guy from Witz, just in case you said yes. Helenus put the guarantee back into his wallet, and I turned to follow him out of the